I don't really know why I'm bringing Mike Leonard on to wax poetic about that. He's a federal defense attorney. But Mike, how are you doing, my friend? I thought I'd bring you on a little early here today. How are you?
Hey, John. Great. Really appreciate it. Following Bob Clifford, the dean, one of the deans of the Illinois Trial Bar, is a tough task. But you're making some great points. And, you know, it even applies, you know, on the civil side. As you know, we represent whistleblowers often at trial. And it's the same concept. You know, if they don't come forward and let it known internally or externally that someone's doing something wrong or illegal, change does not happen. And I think the same concept obviously applies to Bob's cases on a grand scale. So, you know, it's definitely something we experience when we're involved in cases on the civil side, for sure.
I mean, can you just fathom working on a case for 6 years, traveling all over the world to take depositions from so many different people to try and come to some conclusion for people that have experienced the worst nightmares of their life? I mean, I know you do a lot of those sorts of things, but they usually move, although I guess federal court doesn't move all that much faster, Mike. But yeah, you see what I'm getting at there?
Well, yeah, they all take a lot of time. On the civil side, for example, we had a whistleblower case that was brought in three jurisdictions, took about 6 or 7 years, involved deposition, six different states, you know, probably 75 depositions to 100. So, yeah, fortunately or unfortunately, those cases can take, you know, a lot of time as well. Certainly was not international like Bob's referring to. But, yeah, any civil case, even the run-of-the-mill, let's say run-of-the-mill in quotation marks case, from the date suit is filed until you get to trial, and it, just an average normal case that doesn't involve that, still is going to be probably 2 to 3 years. So multiply that, as Bob has done, and you'll see the complexity of some of these cases.
Yeah, I was trying to think, like, is there a way to speed some of this stuff up? But when you take a look at the actual boots on the ground work that needs to be done, I don't know if there is a way to do that.
Well, it depends on the jurisdiction and sort of the leeway that the court gives you in terms of getting through what's called fact discovery, which is just fact witnesses, and then a time period for expert witnesses, which is, in a case like Bob's talking about, is incredibly extensive. So, you know, some jurisdictions will hold the lawyer's feet to a fire and keep them on a harsher schedule and make the case go to trial quicker. But sometimes it's just not realistic, depending upon the complexity of the case. And in fairness, you sometimes want it, and it should take longer because it's very difficult to develop all the facts.
Yeah. We've got about a minute before the news, Mike. You got any questions for me? Sometimes you bring me some questions from, quote-unquote, the listeners. Now would be a good time, but now I'm guessing that this is the one time you don't have a question for me.
Well, putting me on the spot, I guess, since we're at February 1, John, right?
Yeah, my mom's birthday.
Has your year in 2025 changed? Have you done anything with any consistency that's different than 2024? How about that one?
Ooh, I like that. Have I, like, either whether it was a resolution or whether it was just some change I've made?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be, because you told me, I think, you're anti-resolutions, but have you made any differences in your life in the first month of 2024? I think it's often fun to look at our progress as your progresses, but sometimes people don't look at it that way. But we'll put you on the spot, John. What's different about your 2025 so far?
Absolutely nothing, except I've been getting ready to have a baby. Like, that's the one thing that I think I'm laser focused on that so much that I maybe have actually kind of enjoyed, not worried too much about being so busy with work. I don't know. I've chilled out a little bit, Mike, just focusing on that instead of anything else.
Good. Okay. I don't think that's enough detail for the listeners, but I put you on the spot too. So what can we expect?
Yeah. Well, we ate up a good minute there. That was perfect, Mike. Tell you what,
that's
putting you on
matters.
Hold. Yeah, exactly. We moved the needle till we got to the news. I brought Mike Leonard in a little early, but we will start our actual conversation. We'll start with the Mike Madigan trial and any questions you have.
You're listening to Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association with host John Hansen. Today's show is sponsored by Vogelzang Law, Conti and Dolan, and Leonard Trial Lawyers. Now, here's John Hansen, and let's get legal.
At 5:10, WGN. Very happy February the 1st. Hardest month to pronounce, I'd say. February? Mike Leonard, am I saying that right? You're a lawyer. You're smart. February. February?
I'll let you say it. Since it's your show, you can say it any way you want. I do agree with you that the days, the sunlight issue and us getting more light, it seems fantastic already.
Yeah, right? Feeling good. It makes you straighten up your back a little bit, walk a little bit straighter and feel better.
Yes. And January did go by quickly, so I don't know why, how to explain it either. But I'm in agreement with you on 2 points, which I hate to ever
I know you don't like that at all. Mike Leonard is a federal defense attorney, and he's been really covering and looking at the Mike Madigan trial for us while the rest of us bury our heads in the sand in regards to it. But Mike, it's a pivotal moment. It is in the hands of the jury. They've had, what, 3 days of deliberation so far?
Correct, which... in a case of this magnitude, I mean, by magnitude, I mean length. You know, when you have something that's more than 3 months long, it's not unexpected that, of course, you're going to have a long deliberation. So I think 3 days is really nothing, but I do expect a verdict towards the end of this coming week or maybe a couple days into the next week. But I think they'll get it done. I don't think it's going to take, you know, 12 days or 2 weeks for them to get it done. But 3 days so far is not anything out of the ordinary.
Is it excruciating for you and your client? You're not representing Mike Madigan here. I'm making that clear. But like when you are in this jury deliberation period, is it just the worst?
Oh, it's an absolute killer. You know, so whether it takes a few hours or whether it takes a couple of days, all you're doing is wringing your hands and second guessing yourself and thinking of all the things that you believe were sort of dispositive of the case that somehow you did wrong. And you've convinced yourself that somehow, because of those mistakes that you think you made, you're going to lose. And so you're looking at it in an extraordinarily negative light. Even if you think you can win and expect to win, you still look at it through those glasses. And maybe just to steel yourself in case you do. But yeah, it's excruciating.
As sympathetic as I am to you, I imagine it's worse for the client.
Oh, absolutely. You imagine your fate is on the line because you know that it's going to result in whether you're going to be incarcerated for sometimes a very substantial period of time or not, and the effect upon your reputation, your life going forward, your family. I mean, the stakes couldn't be any higher. There's no doubt about it.
How do you pass that time? I mean, really, is it just twiddling your thumbs? Do you try and work on other cases? Do you just try and pump up the client, talk about sports? Like, what do you do?
It's real tough. It's real tough. Everyone has their own sort of way they handle it. Some people don't stay in the building. You know, they leave. They're at their office. They're at their office for as long as it takes. I never leave whatever building it is. I stay there
every
single day till the end.
You try and eat lunch in the lunchroom with the jury.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I my personal thing that I've learned from other trial lawyers is I want them to hopefully see me sitting there when they come in the morning or see me walking into the building, you know, alongside them. I want them to see me in the cafeteria every day. I want them to think that, you know, it really matters to me. And I want my client, obviously, to be there, too, as long as they're not in custody. And so that's my approach. But some people go to their own offices. They can't handle being there because every minute seems like an hour. And we all have our different idiosyncrasies in terms of how we pass the time. But I stay there all day, every day, and I can't get anything done.
Wow. I want to make sure I understand this. Even when a jury is out on deliberations, they got to eat. They don't bring like pizza to the jury room. Like they go eat in the cafeteria and the defendant and the defense team might be at a table nearby, like during jury deliberations.
Oh, sure. But yeah, look, you're not getting too close, but yeah, it's the same as it is during the trial. You know, during the trial, Mike Madigan's walking into the cafeteria. Typically allowed as attorneys. He's getting lunch. He's in the line. He's not speaking to anyone. He's not acknowledging anybody. They're not acknowledging him. Same holds true during the deliberations. I'm not sure what they're doing, whether he's in the building or not. But yeah, you and your client could be sitting in that second floor Dirksen cafeteria building every single day while the jury is deliberating, come down for lunch. Yeah, you're right. Sometimes they take lunch in or have other arrangements. But yeah, You can still have that visibility if you wanted to and if you think that's your technique.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything nefarious about it. It's just the reality of an office space that has a place where people have lunch. I've eaten in that cafeteria too, and it's, I don't know, it's just like this weird thought that you are sitting nearby the people that are deciding your fate over a bite from cafeteria food. It's, I don't know, it's very humbling.
It's pretty crazy, and I think some lawyers, they prefer that they themselves and their clients are not visible in the cafeteria. They would not do that like I do. Everyone's got their different philosophy on how to handle deliberations, but we can all agree it's a killer. It's one of the worst things ever in the world until you win.
Man,
and if you don't,
right,
it's still horrible.
I mean, I would be in lunch. I'd be like, Hey, client, all that charity work you did years ago, remember that? Talk louder about that, please.
Well, John, if you want to get disbarred, yeah, that would be a great technique. So I would pursue that.
We had a couple questions from the jury, although they always cause some drama. I was waiting, I saw an X. Oh, there's been a note from the jury. They have been the most mundane questions so far, Mike.
Yeah, you get questions all the time. No matter how mundane the case is, it's not unusual to get hit with questions. And sometimes they come in quick succession. They come right when they start. Sometimes they come right at the end. And you're always trying to read the tea leaves from the question. Sometimes the tea leaves that can be read are sort of obvious that they're hung up on a certain issue when they're asking about an interpretation of a jury instruction or something like that, or asking for particular testimony. You kind of get a sense of where they are, but it's an inexact science. So sometimes you have no idea what the question means, and sometimes it really ultimately turns out not to mean much, but sometimes it does. So it's hard to draw conclusions from the questions, but I know they had, in this case, questions for, give me more supplies, give me whiteout, give me markers, give me highlighters, you know, things like that, which is I thought was kind of funny.
Yeah, at first I thought, oh, that's just so silly, but I guess that might mean that you've got a jury. Maybe I'm putting my defense attorney's rose-colored glasses here, but if they're asking for whiteout and highlighters, I'm like, ooh, they are paying attention. They are going through this line by line. I like a juror that does that.
Oh, yeah, I would agree with you. I think that's, for the defense, a good sign, and overall for the system, it's a good sign. It clearly seems to me to send a message just to the group of people who are really rolling up their sleeves and trying to get it right. So certainly we can draw that conclusion, and I'm sure they're going to give this thing a ton of attention. You know, whether that means it'll take all of the next week, whether it'll take 2 weeks, who knows, but you do seem to have a very engaged jury, that's for sure.
How many counts are there in this trial? I hate to ask you off the top of your head, but it's a bunch.
23, although, you know, it's a little deceiving in a way, because some of the counts are grouped, meaning that the same type of conduct is at issue. So it's not as if every single individual count will require the same measure of attention, because, you know, sometimes they're so similar that, you know, if you're going to decide one way on something, you're going to consistently find that way. However, it's a difficult one because it's 105 pages of instructions. The elements that the government has to prove are very technical. They look technical to a layperson. They look technical to a lawyer. So it's a decently large task, let's face it.
Is it unusual, or like, I guess you paint me a picture here, when you have that many counts or a case with a lot of counts, I mean, I think the federal attorneys are doing that somewhat on purpose. They feel like the person is guilty of those things, but also they want to score one, right? And I feel like, do you feel like they're usually unanimous, like they all come in one way or the other, or is it more times than not, there's some guilties and not guilties smattered amongst them?
Well, yeah, it's tough to predict when you have counts that are this different in a case like this. You know, some of them just require a completely different sort of intent and different elements than the others. So, look, when you got 23, from the government's perspective, you know, the more counts you have, the more difficult it'll be for the defense to run the table, right? And from the defense perspective, you know, getting them to unanimously find in your favor on all counts is a challenge, especially as the number of counts increase. It just makes sense, right? So, and prosecutors often what we call overcharge, meaning charge it in as many counts as possible with that same attitude in mind.
When you are arguing in front of the jury, maybe in closing arguments, and you have someone that has multiple counts, are you going one by one, Mike? Are you just trying to present a confident, he hasn't done this in any way, the government is saying it, and not trying to get into the technical weeds of each count?
Well, it's both. You got to do both. So what happens is, since the government goes first in the opening of the closing argument, which was hours and hours and hours, right? It was multiple prosecutors presenting that. What they do is they do both. You know, they're persuasively trying to hammer home a theme and theory to the jurors. However, the typical prosecutor way is a PowerPoint, which goes through every count, the elements necessary to prove each count, and then establishing particular pieces of evidence that satisfy each of those elements, which is painstaking, right? And then as a defense lawyer, of course, you got to come back. You're not going to follow necessarily the same structure as a government, probably never. And you have to, again, be persuasive in a general perspective, but you cannot fail to point out how the government's failed to meet their burden on the particular elements. And you're not always, as a defense lawyer, arguing that, hey, the government has failed on each and every element. Some of the elements are conceded. You know, for example, if the government had to prove they needed to prove that an interstate wire communication was used, hey, we don't dispute that. But here's why the government fails on this count. They can't prove elements 2 and 4 or whatever. So you're doing the same thing in reverse. You're trying to show in a persuasive way how particular pieces of evidence establish that the government hasn't met that burden. But yeah, you likewise need this overall theme and theory, and particularly in a case where someone like Madigan testified, it gives you a lot to work with.
Can the fact that there's a lot of charges work in your favor if you've given them, like you're just saying there, we concede to this, is to give jurors an off-ramp for a lesser charge because they feel obligated maybe in some way to find someone guilty, especially a high-profile case, and you are, hey, look at this off-ramp you have. You have these two charges, which are lesser. You don't telestrate it like this, but in a way, do you try and make an argument and show the jury that off-ramp?
Well, it depends on the case. I mean, a case like this, you're definitely trying to run the table, but you're certainly trying to beat the racketeering conspiracy first and foremost. But you're not going to concede any counts. You can't concede any counts because there's a lot of similarity with regard to the conduct in terms of you can't believe that Madigan's lying part of the time or that he's corrupt part of the time. Mm. So you can't make those kind of concessions in a case like this. You might have a case different than this one where, yeah, you really need to win a particular count and you're really putting your eggs in that basket because you know from a sentencing perspective that's the most important thing for you to do. And you might know that it's really going to be very difficult and not persuasive to convince the jury on some other count that you're not going to concede. You're not going to tell them, hey, we're conceding this one, but you're going to put your eggs in the basket of another one. But in the Madigan case, it's difficult, especially since he testified. You know, he can't be half corrupt or half of a briber or anything like that. So you can't really go there.
You have been reading the tea leaves for this case since the beginning. In fact, before the trial even started, you noted the uphill climb you felt the prosecutors had to do. Has anything changed now that you've seen the trial play out?
Yeah, I mean, again, I look at this through a certain perspective, as you know, but I don't think the government got it done. I don't think they proved Madigan guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. I think the jurors are going to want more. And when I say that is that, yeah, they created a picture of a sort of a structure and how Madigan does business. But I feel like at the end of the day, the jury wants to be able to say that, you know, Madigan did or said X, and because of that, someone else did Y. And I think they failed on that crucial part of it. And then I think you add the fact that Madigan testified, and in my view, it would be very difficult for 12 people to unanimously agree that he was lying to them. So I still think the defense takes this one, whether they run the board or whether they get a lot of not guilties and then they get a mistrial, hung jury on some other counts. That's where I'm still going, John. I'm still sticking with that.
You know, there's going to be a lot of listeners upset by that, but I guess that's how the system works. And also, we don't know if that's what is going to happen. That is Mike's
exactly.
opinion.
Hey, John,
yes.
If I could predict them perfectly, I never would lose a case.
Yeah, I was going to say. I mean, like, yeah, check your own bias. We have a question from the 847. Do you have anything you do for good luck, like us sports fans who don't shave a beard during a playoff run? Do you do anything during a trial or certain idiosyncrasies you have, maybe during deliberations, that you go for good luck?
Oh, my God, yes.
What are they?
So during the trial, I'm eating usually the same bad or good meal over and over and over. I found myself recently, over the last couple of years, eating the same horrible veggie wrap at the second floor cafeteria with some eggs almost every day. Ooh. And I hate it, but I feel like it's my thing. And then during deliberations, you know, we're doing a lot of things like sitting around singing old 70s, 80s tunes, just dumb stuff. I think it's partially to pass the time and partially because you're just delirious. But yeah, definitely we have these things that we do over and over every time that we think are good luck. And I also like to have in my pockets good luck charms. It could be a note from my kid from 10 years ago. It could be a piece of a wiffle ball from my deceased friend. It could be anything.
Whoa.
And I always put on my table every single day of the trial the name of this guy that I went to law school with who was a close friend who died. He's there with me at every trial. His name is always on a sticky pad that's on the table. So
wow.
I definitely have these things that I think are good luck, or I guess maybe more memorials too. Who knows?
Wow, that was really sweet, Mike. I mean, not the lunch. And you singing 70s or 80s songs. Boy, I want to see that in person one day. But lawyers, they're just like us.
Yep, yep. And, wow. You know, sometimes the most amazing occurrence, John, happened when I was listening to a tune on the way to the courthouse during jury deliberations. I got into the building, got into the cafeteria. The same song was playing. Come on. What better omen is that? And we won. So,
I was going to say, yeah.
If you get that, John, you're going to win every time.
I was going to say, a good omen can turn into a bad omen, depending on what the juror says. Mike Leonard helps us on this journey to get there. He's a federal defense attorney, also works with whistleblower litigation as well. And, Mike, we're starting to get some questions, and you ready to answer them?
Let's do it, John. Can't wait.
By the way, a couple listeners found it very endearing, your story of your good luck charms along the way. Very sweet of you. You mentioned before, when we brought you on about an hour or so ago, you were right after Bob Clifford. And I'm kind of curious, like, you obviously respect Bob Clifford, who was on earlier. There's other lawyers out there I'm sure you have taken lessons from. Like, do you all kind of watch each other to learn how to do a better job with cases, even if you guys all try different types of cases?
Well, John, Clifford's not watching me, but I would watch Clifford. no, the amazing thing is when I was in law school, which is like 1989, 90, 91, we had trial practice class, right? And our professor who was in charge of that brought in people like Bob Clifford and Judge Gino DeVito and other people like that who at the time – we didn't even really understand who they were and what kind of lions they were in the community in terms of trying cases. And we're getting instruction from these people, just incredible experience. And then, you know, you get lucky in your career trying cases with people, you know, you're the first or second or distant third chair. When I was young, third year lawyer, I got to try a murder case. I put try in quotation marks with Kunkel, who was probably one of the most famous, you know, Cook County prosecutors ever was, Bill Kunkel, and I was the distant third, meaning I got no witnesses, I got no action at the trial, but I was the gopher, and I was there every day, and I was carrying his bags, and I probably never learned as much in my life as I did from being on that trial. So absolutely, these lawyers who are great at what they do make a huge impact upon you. You know, you can't copy them, but you certainly definitely learn an unbelievable amount, which you can't even quantify.
Is it how they interact with the jury, their performance in the courtroom, sometimes maybe how they work with their clients? Is it all sorts of things, how they interact with the judge? Are you just picking up little things along the way?
Yeah, it's everything. You know, for example, with Conkwell, the thing I thought was most interesting is that, you know, it was this big-time murder case in Kenilworth, Illinois. I think they probably hadn't had a murder there in, you know, 50 years. And, you know, just to watch how he prepared for the trial, which was, in his case, spending hours, days just reading the stuff over and over and over so that, you know, and he's known as having incredible memory. But the idea was that he just needed to know everything there was, everything anyone ever said in a witness statement, so that it was all internalized. So, you know, people would say, how do you remember this? How do you remember that? Because you spent hours, days reading it again and again, and you knew every fact there was. You know who said what. Just the preparation from him was incredible. And that just to see his approach on cross-examination for a young lawyer, get to watch that. But, yeah, you pick up different pieces from everybody. You know, I worked with a guy named Bruce Meckler, and he was as gung-ho as they came. And just that sort of enthusiasm for the practice and how you interact with clients. But, yeah, you pick stuff up from everybody, and you kind of make it your own.
I'm always blown away when I watch trials or the footage from trials on one of these shows, right, that you watch when they, well, the Menendez brothers, whatever the case may be, a televised trial, how an inconsistency of an expert witness by the prosecution, man, that defense attorney better know every little wrinkle of the case, because Otherwise, how would you pick up on those sorts of things?
Yeah, it's a great point. And, you know, the cross-examine like that, yeah, there is some stuff that happens on cross that's ad hoc, off the cuff, responsive to what a witness said. However, the unknown secret, maybe, or the known secret amongst lawyers, incredible amount of preparation goes into those cross-examinations. So you know any point that matters to you, you know where you can go, what document, what pretrial statement, what deposition testimony you can go to what's called impeach that witness. You have it written down in your outline. So if they give you a wrong answer or try to go to something that you think is untruthful or inconsistent, you have it written down and you're going to go to it and you're going to impeach them. So it's not just on the fly saying, oh, I gotcha. You know, so much goes into it before the trial, which makes trial work very hard. You know, just all the prep that goes into making it look like you're this genius who, oh, I gotcha, because I gotcha on page 47 where you said something different. Well, if you didn't do all the work before the trial, that would never happen.
630 wants to know, and I think it stems off this line of questioning I'm offering to you right now, Mike. Does Mike ever wish he had a soundtrack in the courtroom so that dramatic moments actually landed with the jury, like when we watch on TV?
What do you mean? Like as you got somebody
as
else?
As you got someone, and yeah, you get to get some dun-dun or some moment.
Oh, that would be so beautiful. It would be almost like an episode of Law & Order where, you know, bing, you got him. That would be phenomenal. I would love
because
that
there's person. Got there's had to have been a moment that you're like, that landed, and you look over at the jury and there's one person whose eyes are not concentrating or something. You're like, oh man, did they miss what I just did?
Oh yeah. Well, but the opposite's true a lot too. Like sometimes if you really get somebody on cross, which is, you know, it doesn't happen all the time and it doesn't happen to every witness, but when you really got somebody and you're looking at the jury, and sometimes you do it intentionally just to be a drama queen, and you're getting the head nods and the smiles or the smirks or the laughs, you feel great, right? And you're getting that verification in real time that, okay, that landed. And like, you're right, other times you think you've scored some great point, you look over and juror number 12 is literally asleep or yawning or looking at their watch, and you're like, oh, I guess that wasn't as significant as I thought.
Well, can you re-rack it in real time then and try and almost like replicate, like, I don't know, like make a loud noise, make sure they know they're paying attention. You got to kind of read that room and like put on you're not Billy Flynn, but a performance like that in some ways.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I do believe, and I still will always believe, that jurors want drama. They've seen TVs. They've seen movies. They have an expectation of what a trial's like. They want to see certain things happen. They have an expectation of things happening. So sometimes you have to create or bring drama to a particular witness. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But yeah, you have to read the room. And sometimes it means stopping your examination. Like, this is not going anywhere with them. Less is more here, right? And sometimes you're getting the affirmation as you're going that, no, this really is working, and it might be in an unexpected way. So yeah, you definitely have to read the room, meaning the jurors and their eyes and their facial expressions and their reactions to you and to the witness.
217 wants to know, does he ever object just for the sake of showing his client that he's paying attention with a judge, and even though if he knows he's going to lose that objection?
No, it's not for the client, but it could be tactical for the juror. It could be tactical to try to keep something out or make a point with your objection, even if you know it's going to be overruled. But it's really not for the client. I mean, I think there are lawyers out there that think if the client sees them so-called fighting for them by doing stupid objections or too many objections, they think that's a good thing. But if you're trying to please your client by your objections, you're probably not going to do very well.
I don't know if you can answer this question, Mike, but this just came in from the 708. How does one determine whether to join a class action lawsuit or just file a suit separately? I was part of a Windows lawsuit in the early 2000s. I got all of $4,000 for 23 defective Windows that cost me $28,000. Wasn't anywhere where I thought I was going to get. That's an interesting question about whether you jump on with a team of other people or you go your own route.
Well, it's a real tough call. So, for example, if you're an individual, and let's say this, did the gentleman say or the woman say $28,000?
They had paid $28,000 for these windows, and they only got $4,000 for their settlement with the class action lawsuit.
So the difficulty is, let's say I decided, hey, I don't want to join the class. I'm going to go at a loan. Okay, number one, if your damages are $28,000, it's going to be hard to get a lawyer to take your individual case because, you know, they're working on the contingency, right? So they're going to get 33 or 40% of that $28,000. You might need an expert witness to testify to establish the defectiveness of the window. that expert witness might cost more than the $28,000 you're trying to recover, right?
Whoa, really?
So, yeah, so by joining the class, obviously you don't need 4,000 experts. You need one expert to establish, for instance, causation or defect or whatever. So sometimes it's just not feasible to go it on your own. I mean, you can do that tactically sometimes, and sometimes tactically that may result in a quick settlement. But other times it's just not affordable, and it's hard to get counsel to represent you if you go at it that way. That's just the reality of the economics sometimes of litigation.
I never really thought about this, although I know that that witnesses are paid. Are witnesses paid on both sides of the equation, like prosecutors that have expert witnesses, they're paid to be there? Same with defense experts?
Well, it's a little different. So in the prosecutorial world, a lot of the witnesses they call as experts are government employees. So, for example, there might be someone who works for the DOJ or is a tax expert or whatever. So they actually work for the government. They're getting their salary from the government. However, there are cases where even the government has to get an outside expert who's not a government employee. And, of course, they're paid, right? Just like if we get an expert, they're paid. And so this whole thing of how much is your expert paid per hour to testify doesn't really get anywhere, because usually there's the same goes both ways, right? So
do they ever bring it up? Do the prosecutors ever be like, how much are you getting paid to testify in this case for Mike Leonard?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's a fair, to try to establish bias for cross-examination. Of course, you're always going to think about doing that, but you have to be careful, because if your witness is getting paid also and at the same rate or maybe a lesser
more.
Rate,
oh, yeah.
where does that go? So usually the battle of the experts comes down to their credentials and how they present to the jury. They're usually very skilled people in terms of their communication ability, but some experts are not good at that, right? So you might have an expert who maybe is lesser trained and lesser experienced than another, but they present well. They come across as a good person. They understand the dynamics of a jury, even though they may be much lesser qualified. The jury is more apt to go with them because they seem like a credible, nice person. You know what I mean?
Interesting. So the communication skills of a witness may play as big a role in you determining who you're going to use as their level of expertise on the subject you're bringing them there for.
Oh, no doubt. And then, you might have a witness or a group of witnesses that you can choose from. And some of them may just be horrible with the way they present on the stand. So if you get the choice, which is not always your choice, but if you have a choice, of course you want to present someone who's, if you have your druthers, attractive, right, well-spoken, a great communicator, and more importantly, comes across as a nice person and or credible person.
Man, I could learn anything. Qualities. I could learn something about everything. Make me an expert witness. Mike, come on, bring me in. I'll be great for you there on the trial. Then they're going to play this clip, and then it'll dismiss me.
Next time when I'm looking for the genius for, radio and TV, you're my guy, John. But, until that happens, I might have to get...
I'll do anything. I can act like an expert in anything. That's what I do literally on this any program. Us radio hosts, we know everything an inch deep and a mile wide, but we're good at communicating it. Mike Leonard, Leonard Trial Lawyers. Mike, how can people reach you, by the way, in case they need your services?
Sure. 312-380-6559. Or we're at leonardtriallawyers.com. And like we said before, we represent individuals in criminal cases that are pending or are going to be brought, or someone's made aware of the fact that they're being investigated at the state or federal level. And then on the civil side, we'll represent individuals in whistleblower cases.
Here's what I want everyone to do. Go into the contacts on your cell phone and start a new contact. And you can name the first name defense lawyer and the second name Mike Leonard, because that's the important thing is when you need a defense lawyer, you don't want to try and remember, who is that guy I heard on WGN? Just write defense in there, and Mike Leonard's name and phone number will pop up again. All right, so everyone has put in their contact, Mike, defense lawyer, and what is the number one more time?
312-380-6559.
We'll do that number once more before we say goodbye to Mike for tonight. Mike, I know I got a question that you want me to ask you in just a moment, but I wanted to ask one more from a texter, if that's okay. First, the 630 wants to know, for Mr. Mike Leonard, do you have any recommendations when selecting which law school to attend? Our daughter has scholarship offers from Michigan State, U of I, Urbana-Champaign, and Indiana University. What should she consider when selecting a law school? First of all, Mike, that's awesome. Scholarships from three Big Ten schools.
Wow, that's fantastic.
And Iowa's not on the list. Ha ha.
Well, John, you know, they call still the Harvard of Chicago is Loyola. So that's still the Harvard of Chicago, okay. Loyola University. Okay. Oh, that's where I went, John.
Oh, how about that?
But in any event, I would love to talk to the listener more about it. If they wanted to give me a call, I could give them, you know, a more extensive answer. But one of the things you have to think about is kind of where do you want to end up? Not just practice area, but geographically, like where do you want to practice? Because, you know, those are all great schools, all great choices. The money issue is huge with law school these days. And if someone's giving me an incomplete or complete scholarship, that's going to be a huge factor. But I think you also got to think about where do you want to practice geographically. So, for example, you know, the Chicago schools, you know, there might be, you know, we have, what, 5 law schools in Chicago. And, you know, sometimes one of those choices, they might not be in terms of the rankings the same as a school somewhere else. But that school is so heavily tied to the Chicago legal community and has so many lawyers in the legal community of Chicago from those schools that sometimes it makes sense if you want to end up here in Chicago to practice to go to one of those schools. It's a huge factor and it really helps you with externship jobs, with clerking, with all those things that go into your future. So I think that's a hugely important thing that sometimes people don't think about enough in advance, right? Because you might go somewhere geographically far away and it might be a great school and it might even be better ranked than a school here. But that school has much less, more of a tenuous connection to Chicago and the Chicago market than somewhere here that's might not maybe ranked as high. So I'd love to talk to them more if they had questions, you know, offline.
Okay. That's a long way of saying U of I or Man of Champaign, by the way. ILL.
No, Loyola still. I'd still go Loyola number one.
Loyola was not on the list of this person's text, Mike.
Well, maybe they can get a scholarship somehow. Maybe you can, John, you can do a GoFundMe page for them. I don't know. You'd be creative here.
Mike Leonard can be reached at, what was the number one more time for them?
312-380-6559, although I won't be working tonight, John.
Okay, call on Monday or some other time.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to them about it. Yeah, that's a great subject.
That's for sure. Mike, what's the concept? I love how I'm pretending this is from a listener. This is Mike texting me himself. Mike, you wanted me to ask you about the concept of the rebuttal argument in closing argument. Map out how a closing argument works. What is this rebuttal argument, you say?
Yeah, so it really is very applicable to the Madigan trial, any federal criminal trial, any state court criminal trial. So what happens is, of course, the government has the burden of proof. They go first, and they give their closing argument. And so oftentimes, you're sitting there as a defense lawyer, and you're thinking, they're burying me. You know, I got to get up there. I got to bring this jury back, right? And you get up, and you do, hopefully, a phenomenal job in your close, and you feel like, I brought the jury back. I'm going to win this case, right? But there's this thing called rebuttal, which is often a killer, right? And so the government gets the last word. You would think
Why?
In some ways that, well, because the theory is, since they have the burden of proof, they get the last word. I feel like it should be the opposite. Since you're presumed innocent and they have to prove you guilty beyond reasonable, I feel like the defense should get the last word. But that's not how it works, right? So you get up there, you give the defense close, you think it's gone great, you think you brought the jury back, you think you're going to win. And then the rebuttal comes, right? And the government gets the last word. So they get to get up and they can really just poke holes in what you just said, you know, so they can do it in a mocking way. They can do it in a sarcastic way. They can have little zingers, you know, about what you just said. They can play off wordplay that you just used and they can take highlights that you just made and then counteract them with other evidence. So oftentimes, in my view, a lot of times it comes down to who wins is the government's rebuttal closer excellent, right? Mm. And sometimes you get lucky and they're not, right? And you think, that rebuttal, they didn't hit us very hard. We're still very much in this game. Other times you feel like, they got us. You know, there's some closers that one comes to mind that still haunts me. His name's Chris Parente in federal criminal cases that always was a great rebutter and would always kill us in rebuttal. And so, therefore, I hated him, but now he's a friend.
Oh, nice. Is he still attorney for the U.S. government?
No, now he's no longer a federal prosecutor.
Well, there you go.
Now
you're friends.
Guy. Now he's a defense lawyer.
Ah, yes. Okay. Hey, we got to get going, Mike. Who should be calling you? 20-second elevator pitch.
Yeah, anybody, John, who's been contacted, meaning that they're possibly facing charges, being investigated, or, of course, already charged and facing charges at the federal or state level. And, of course, on the civil side, anyone who is a whistleblower or has a whistleblower case to bring or to talk about. Those are the people we represent.
Phone number one more time.
312-380-6559. And, John, thanks a lot for all your time today.
Mike Leonard, you're the best.